he said, and we ought not to be doing the job for him. Kennedy's statement gave him the opportunity to remind his audience that supporting Eisenhower was what he had been having his Democratic senators do for 8 years. As for apologizing, it was Mr. Khrushchev who broke up the summit meeting by refusing to talk to the president other than in insulting language. It is not the American president who ought to apologize to Mr. Khrushchev. It is Mr. Khrushchev who ought to apologize to the American president. Audiences responded. At every stop, with increasing fire and to increasing applause, he is holding up the hand of the president in the new Cold War, the columnist Mary McGrory wrote. Sharpening his rhetoric, he trained it on the candidate who had suggested regrets. By the time he reached Spokane, where he spoke to the Washington State Democratic Convention, he was shouting, "I am not prepared to apologize to Mr. Khrushchev, are you? I am not prepared to send regrets to Mr. Khrushchev, are you?" And to each question, the audience shouted back, "No, no." And it wasn't only an issue that was working for Lyndon Johnson in the West. It was also his personality. Stiff, stilted, and unconvincing though he had been when delivering prepared speeches during his congressional and Senate campaigns, shouting sentences without inflection, his gestures as awkward as his phrasing, when in the latter stages of some of these campaigns he had realized he was losing and in desperation threw away his text and spoke directly to his audience, he was suddenly something quite different. Lyndon Johnson, without a speech in his hand, as I wrote about his first seemingly hopeless campaign, Lyndon Johnson alone and unprotected on a flatbed truck, no paper to hide behind, nothing to look at but the faces of strangers, Lyndon Johnson with nothing to rely on but himself, was suddenly, gangling and big-eared and awkward though he remained, a candidate with a remarkable gift for establishing rapport with an audience. In 1960, of course, his platforms were not flatbed trucks, but elaborately bunting-draped stages, and the candidate was no longer skinny and gangling, but on this trip into the West, there were nonetheless moments that recalled those desperate early days. On the Saturday of that hectic trip, he was so far behind schedule that Governor Herseth had provided a helicopter. It wasn't the tiny Sikorsky flying windmill, that then revolutionary machine in which he had swooped across Texas in 48, but it was a helicopter, and the planes he was flying over were planes as flat as those of Texas. And the audiences he spoke to during these days in the West had issues they shared with Texans, and those were the issues he spoke about. Back in his plane, he was flying over the Great West's rivers, the Columbia, the Colorado, the Snake, the Pecos, the Platte, and over the tiny gray-white lines across them that were the great dams the government had built to tame their floods, to make their waters work for electricity and irrigation. He flew on the second of those western days over Hell's Canyon itself. Dams were the symbol of what government could do for the West, and he told his audiences about the dams he had built in Texas and what they had done for the people of the Hill Country. Flying over Oregon, he had noticed strange lines in the earth far below, and someone had explained to him that they were ruts left by the wagon trains in which settlers had come into the Northwest. Those tracks had reminded him of the wagon trains that had come into the Texas Hill Country, he said, and had reminded him also that those who remain behind in older sections don't grasp the West, don't understand it, and that is the West's number one roadblock and problem. He spoke sometimes in terms out of another era, of the era of the populists, of the People's Party, which had been founded in the Hill Country not far from Johnson City. He told Western ranchers that the world of high finance was cheating them, that its bias against the West was reflected in high interest rates on the financing for the development projects the West needed, and in discriminatory freight rates when they sent cattle and goods to market. That's why the West needed leadership which understands not how to keep the West in its place, but how to give the West its place in the sun. The West, Lyndon Johnson said, needs a champion in Washington. In Theodore White's book on the 1960 presidential campaign, he linked the name of Lyndon Baines Johnson with the name of a Democratic presidential candidate from another century. If Lyndon Johnson could become the candidate of the West, as well as the South, White wrote, if he could add its delegate votes to those of the South, He could stand as the candidate of the Wide Open Spaces, the candidate of the William Jennings Bryan Crescent, against the preponderant Northeastern Bloc. And if he could do that, White wrote, if he could in effect become another Bryan, he had a realistic chance of winning the Democratic nomination. Let Kennedy be stopped on the first ballot or two, and this crescent would close on the northern delegates and roll east to victory. Whether or not the people Lyndon Johnson was talking to now ever thought of Bryan's name, and no newspaper mentioned it, and this author has been able to find no book other than White's that does, either. The people to whom Lyndon Johnson was speaking recognized the similarity between his background and theirs. The fact that he was wearing boots didn't hurt, of course, and neither did the accent. The southernness had faded from his voice. It was a West Texas twang now. A Wyoming rancher, trying to explain to Mary McGrory why he was for Johnson, said, "He has an honest-sounding voice." Whatever the reason, the lieutenant governor of one western state was aboard his plane, and the governor of another, South Dakota's Herseth, told reporters, "There's no question but that he's picking up support." Returning from a western trip, the columnist Doris Fleeson wrote that on it Lyndon Johnson had been a lion on the platform, a charmer in cozy conferences with delegates. Journalists reported that, as one of them wrote, party leaders as well as correspondents traveling on the plane with Johnson agreed that he had improved his position in the presidential sweepstakes in every state. The West? Had he only started campaigning earlier, he could have locked that place up without any difficulty at all, Ted Kennedy said. Looking at that trip that Lyndon Johnson finally made at the end of May 1960, it is easy to speculate about what he might have cost himself by his years of procrastination. If he had held the West, the convention might well have been deadlocked, been thrown into the back rooms from which he was certain he would emerge as the nominee. And it is easy to speculate, had he only started sooner, he could have held the West. But now, it was too late. The Kennedys had been sowing in the West for 2 years, and now, almost as soon as Johnson returned from his Memorial Day trip, the Kennedys began to reap. Although none of the reporters understood the significance, there had been indications that during the trip itself it was too late. 7 states, not 6, had been on the original itinerary. 1 of the 7, Montana, had been quietly dropped even while the convair was heading west. Confident that he could count on that state, one of its senators, Mike Mansfield, was his assistant leader, after all. Johnson had told Roe to schedule a full day of appearances there. Montana was Roe's home state, however, and when he began telephoning his old political allies, the reports he received were so disturbing that he contacted Johnson, who was already on his way, and told him to postpone his visit. The reports were correct, as Roe was defined, when, 2 weeks later, he arrived on the scene himself to prepare for the Democratic State Convention in Helena on June 27th. Reporting to Jenkins over the phone on June 23rd, he told him that Kennedy was ahead in Montana, and Symington next. Symington has 7 people in here plus 2 airplanes, and they are really covering the territory. The Kennedys were playing hardball with the delegates, he said. We had to do everything very quietly because every single time somebody comes out in the open for Johnson, the Kennedy crowd move in on him. Just before the convention, Mansfield finally arrived in Helena, only to inform Roe that, in Roe's words, he's for Johnson, but he won't tell anyone who to vote for. Though Johnson had been planning to address the convention, on the morning it opened, Roe telephoned him and said, "Don't come. We are going to get badly licked." Another indication had come in Idaho, at the Idaho Falls Airport, where the delegation welcoming Johnson had been led by 35-year-old Frank Church, who was, in the Senate, a favorite of the majority leader. Johnson had given him a key role in the 57 civil rights battle, and then a seat on foreign relations, simply bypassing 6 senators with greater seniority to do so. Having assessed Church's ambition, he had once scribbled a note to him at a committee meeting to assure him he would help him realize it. He had, the note said, asked Drew Pearson, "to help me give you a build-up over the years, so that one day you can be our president." A faster build-up had been promised by the Kennedys, however. In return for his support, they had offered Church, a stirring orator, the role of keynoter in Los Angeles, a role that Church believed would catapult him to national prominence. Church had agreed. Johnson had heard rumors that this was the case, and, reading the young senator's eyes over the toothy smile he gave him at the airport, he saw it was true. Walking toward the terminal, he told Horace Busby, "The little son of a bitch is already sold out. They bought him." The halter and bridle had been slipped on Western delegates by Robert Kennedy, and Robert Kennedy was not a man to allow someone who had accepted the halter to take it off. One of Idaho's delegates, a state legislator, had been moved by a Johnson speech, but had earlier given his pledge to Bobby Kennedy. When a reporter asked him if he would change, he replied that he simply couldn't. Bobby, he said, was not a man who ever forgave a broken promise. In the weeks after his return to Washington, Johnson frantically worked the telephone for hours every day, and since the time was earlier in the West, for hours every evening. His father had been a farmer, he told the head of a Minnesota farmer's grange. The hill country was a land of farmers. "You and I have got a lot in common, and I don't think you and your people have any with Boston." And he was flying to New York, to Oklahoma, back to Iowa. In May and June 1960, Johnson logged 31,250 miles back and forth across the United States, making 36 speeches and holding 27 press conferences. But state by state, in rapid-fire order now, his mistake in relying on senators was exposed. With Anderson and Chavez behind him, he had taken New Mexico for granted. Every delegate count on those laminated cards in his breast pocket had had all 17 states from Texas's backyard in the Johnson column. But when, a week after his western trip, New Mexico's Democrats held their state convention, at which the delegates were actually selected, Kennedy received 7 of the 17. The successful Kennedy raid deep in Johnson's southwestern backyard shook the Johnson camp, the New York Times reported. In later maneuvering before the convention, Johnson would get 3 of them back. Then there was Carl Hayden's Arizona. That state had a unit rule, and suddenly Kennedy had all 17 of its votes. In Colorado, Edwin "Big Ed" Johnson was denied even a seat on the delegation. Montana, New Mexico, Arizona, Colorado, Wyoming. By the end of June, the West was gone. For so many months, Irv Hoff had urged Lyndon Johnson to campaign in the West. He had put it off and put it off and put it off as long as he could, Hoff would say. And he put it off too long. The desperation with which Lyndon Johnson was trying for the nomination now was visible not only in public, but behind closed doors. Roe and Corcoran and Connolly and Clark saw that they had been right all along, that because he wanted it so much, eventually he was going to do it, was eventually going to get in all the way. Having finally accepted Roe's offer of help, he asked him for advice. And when Roe told him bluntly, "Kennedy has got this. There's only one way to stop him that I can see. That's for Adlai to give a signal that he was willing to be drafted," he acted on it. If the two-time nominee could attract enough votes, Roe was saying, they might, combined with Johnson's and a few from Symington and the favorite sons, be enough to deny Kennedy a first ballot victory. Long though that shot may have been, Johnson tried it, suggesting in a number of conversations with Stevenson that Adlai let his people be more active. Johnson's argument, according to a Stevenson aide, was, "Now listen, Adlai, just hang loose here. Don't make any commitments. You may still get it. Don't help that kid Kennedy. Just stay neutral." And the argument may have been persuasive. "I believe that Governor Stevenson made a commitment to him that he would do that," the aide says. At the end of the month, when Arthur Kroc told Kennedy that Adlai had started making a real effort for the nomination, Kennedy said, "And how?" On Capitol Hill, Johnson held a lot of cards, and now he was playing them. In several states crucial to his presidential hopes, Senate seats were becoming vacant in 1960, and some of the Democrats running for them, Thorne Lord of New Jersey and Representative Lee Metcalf of Montana, for example, had been promised financial support by the Senate Democratic Campaign Committee. Now these candidates were told that that support would be rationed out in inverse proportion to their support of Kennedy, and not only cash, but committee assignments were in Johnson's hand. What had he said to Governor Lovelace in that brief meeting aboard his plane? Lovelace was to tell an Iowa politician that his Senate assignments were going to depend on his convention activities. To all these men, it was becoming apparent, Johnson was saying, in effect, "Vote for me if you can, but if you can't, just don't vote for Kennedy." And to all these men, the message had been delivered in firm terms. After talking to Lovelace, the Iowa politician said, "Rough stuff. These boys aren't playing for peanuts." "I'm not what you call a Kennedy fan," one unidentified governor told the Wall Street Journal, "but these Johnson tactics almost have me mad enough to become one." One card in Johnson's hand could be played only if Sam Rayburn, who held the same card, agreed to play his. The Speaker had been reluctant to play it, telling Johnson its use would be too raw, but Representative Richard Bolling, a witness to some of their discussions, says that at 78, Sam was just old now. Lyndon finally wore him down. On June 29th, without warning, the two Texans suddenly announced that, rather than Congress adjourning for the year before the convention, as had been expected, it would instead immediately recess and return to complete the session on August 8th, after the convention. Longtime congressional observers could recall only one maneuver even faintly comparable. Harry Truman's 1948 masterstroke following the Republican convention of calling the Republican-controlled Congress back into session and challenging it to deliver on the convention's campaign platform. Truman, however, had been challenging a Republican Congress in which he had limited influence. Johnson and Rayburn were talking about a Congress they controlled. Rayburn's "word is virtually law among Democrats in the House," James Reston noted. Power over legislation senators and congressmen wanted, or needed, to satisfy demands of their constituents, was in the hands of the two Texans, and in the hands of the committee chairman who wanted Johnson to get the nomination. With the new congressional schedule, Johnson and Rayburn would be holding this legislation over the heads of senators and representatives in Los Angeles. As James Reston wrote, the theory was that the two Texans would be able, by their influence over legislation in the recessed session, to induce 40 or 50 delegates to support Mr. Johnson. Evans and Novak were to call the audacious maneuver blatant political blackmail. As the Senate, in previous years so efficient under Johnson, had dawdled through the year, there had indeed been speculation that the majority leader had, as the New York Times was to put it, engineered a Senate slowdown to keep control of the fate of major bills during the Democratic convention. The speculation had been discounted because the maneuver would be too extreme an exercise of power. There was, in reality, not much chance it would succeed, for the same reason that Johnson's reliance on senators wasn't succeeding. While he had power over them, they didn't have power over their delegations. His use of it made clear, however, the lengths to which he was going in his last-ditch effort to get the nomination. Worked up, revved up now, Lyndon Johnson had convinced himself he was going to defeat Kennedy. He believed that thoroughly now. It was, after all, his destiny. "I was meant to be president." Governor Lawrence had seen it. "The man has sold himself." Now Johnson, meeting with a group of senators in the Taj Mahal, waved a copy of a newspaper article predicting a Kennedy win and laughed at it. The winner was going to be him, he said. "The bandwagon is rolling, boys. You might as well get on board." And he was worked up about his opponent. While he had begun deriding Kennedy as soon as the Massachusetts senator began running for the presidency, calling him the boy, or in a contemptuous tone, Sonny Boy, or Johnny, or Little Johnny, saying that he was just a rich kid whose daddy was trying to buy him the nomination, in public, for a time, he confined himself to the age issue. "He's a nice, attractive young man," he would say, heavily underlining the final adjective. "And the absenteeism issue. Jack was out kissing babies while I was passing bills, including his bills." And the contrast between their roles in the Senate. Johnson likes to portray himself as the man who made Senator Kennedy what he is today by securing him choice committee assignments, David Broder reported. He looks with paternal pride on the accomplishments of Kennedy, Symington, and all the others who flourished so well under his care. As it became apparent that Kennedy's bid was serious, however, in public the paternalistic note faded and the jabs became sharper. To a press conference question about Kennedy, he responded that with the Cold War in such a serious phase, the United States shouldn't be represented in world councils by someone second class. After Kennedy said he would have expressed regret to Khrushchev, the word guts became a standard word in Johnson's platform rhetoric, and the jabs started to be thrown in combination. It is up to the American people in their wisdom to judge whether a man of that age can lead the country. The next president should have a little gray in his hair, wisdom in his heart, and guts under his belt. A full-page newspaper ad, which his campaign took out in May in 18 cities across the country, said, "We cannot afford to gamble with inexperience, immaturity." Jack Kennedy's father had been an appeaser, Lyndon was to say. "I wasn't any Chamberlain umbrella man. I never thought Hitler was right." In private, he was funnier. Riding in an elevator in the Capitol with a Republican congressman, Walter Judd of Minnesota, Johnson asked him, "Have you heard the news?" "What news?" Judd responded. "Jack's pediatricians have just given him a clean bill of health," Johnson said. And not so funny. Although Humphrey and Symington would make small cracks about Kennedy, Hugh Sidey would observe, they were never bitter. They knew the game, and the closest they'd get to being bitter was that he was a rich, spoiled kid who had never had to make it. The most vicious evaluation of Senator Kennedy was from Johnson, and that got quite violent at times. After a campaign trip to Oklahoma in June, he offered Peter Lisagor of the Chicago Daily News a ride back to Washington on the conveyor, and Lisagor was to recount, "All of the enmity and hostility that he held for the Kennedys came out. He called Kennedy a little scrawny fellow with rickets, and God knows what other kind of diseases. He said, 'Have you ever seen his ankles? They're about so round.'" And Johnson made a tiny circle with his fingers. There were other flights with Lyndon Johnson, jacket and tie off, sitting beside other reporters, pouring out his feelings about the boy, the Texas twang clear and sharp through the hum of the engines. Even reporters who had covered Johnson for years were startled by the depth of his feelings. "It is amazing to note the changes that have come over the man," Robert G. Spivak wrote on June 27th. "One day he is the ingratiating, let's all be friends, political glad-hander. The next day he is a rough, tough, kick-and-gouge fighter who will destroy anyone who gets in the way. Johnson seems determined that no matter what happens to his presidential ambitions, the one who must not become president of the United States is the man he contemptuously calls Johnny Kennedy." One issue he had stayed away from was health. For a candidate who had suffered a major heart attack, health wasn't a sure winner. But now any card he held had to be played. A decade before, as the chief counsel of Johnson's preparedness investigating subcommittee, Donald Cook had impressed Johnson as a very sharp lawyer and investigator. Now he was president of the American Power Company, but at the end of June, Johnson drafted him to investigate Jack Kennedy's health. Going directly to Frank Brew, who was president of a pharmaceutical manufacturing company, has, as Cook was to tell Walter Jenkins, a great many doctor contacts around the country, Cook quickly struck pay dirt. "Brew told me about this Addison's disease," he told Jenkins. "Kennedy was treated for it in the Leahy Clinic in Boston. I am told he not only had it, but has it now and is receiving treatment for it." By the next day, Cook had the name of a doctor, Louis Herxthal, who he said had treated Kennedy for Addison's disease at Leahy, and the fact that "the records of the case are not kept in the general clinic files, but in Herxthal's personal records." He told a Johnson aide, Arthur Perry, to tell Johnson that Kennedy was under Herxthal's care, right down to the present time, and that the medication given for Addison's creates what the doctors call a psychic problem, including a split personality and very neurotic behavior patterns. Cook suggested that the story be leaked to some news hound without involving the senator. But Johnson took a role himself, telephoning a California internist who had once worked at Leahy in an attempt to confirm that Kennedy had the disease. Despite the doctor's refusal to provide this confirmation, however, Johnson decided to make the issue public. Not himself, of course. Publicly, he stayed above the fray, refusing to get into the health issue at all, but having John Connolly and India Edwards hold a press conference, in which Mrs. Edwards said that Kennedy did indeed have Addison's disease, which she defined as something to do with lymph glands. She added that doctors have told me he would not be alive if not for cortisone. But the Kennedys deflected the attack with their usual skill. Seizing on the fact that the classic cause of Addison's was tuberculosis, which Jack Kennedy did not have, his Addison's was caused by other factors, Robert Kennedy said that his brother does not now, nor has he ever had, an ailment described classically as Addison's disease, which is a tuberculosis destruction of the adrenal gland, that his brother had only some adrenal insufficiency, which is not in any way a dangerous condition, and that any statement to the contrary is malicious and false, despicable tactics, a sure sign of the desperation of the opposition. Evidently, there are those within the Democratic Party who would prefer that if they cannot win the nomination themselves, they want the Democrat who does win to lose in November. Sorensen went further, evidently feeling himself justified by the fact that Kennedy was taking not cortisone, but a cortisone derivative. He told a reporter flatly, "He is not on cortisone." And when the reporter asked him what other drugs Kennedy might be using, he said, "I don't know that he is on anything, any more than you and I are on." So successful were the Kennedys that the next day New York's Carmine DiSapio, friendly to Johnson, had an intermediary relay a message to the candidate that Mrs. Edwards's statement had backfired and was going to hurt badly not Kennedy but Johnson, and that Johnson should disavow it, which Johnson did. None of his cards took a trick. It was just too late. On July 5th, with the convention just 6 days away, standing, as Mary McGrory sarcastically put it, before the barn door and declaring that the horse has not been stolen, Lyndon Johnson said the words he had never said before. "I am, as of this moment, a candidate for the office of President of the United States." His voice suddenly broke as he was reading that sentence. "I had never heard him do that before," Horace Busby says. The announcement, delivered in the auditorium of the new Senate office building, packed with reporters and cheering Senate staffers, and with Rayburn's bald head shining in the front row, was filled with jabs at his leading opponent's failure to condemn McCarthy. He himself, he said, had been a working liberal when Joe McCarthy had been at the height. At his absences from the Senate, he himself had stayed on the job while those who have engaged in active campaigns have missed hundreds of votes. "The next president is not going to be a talking president or a traveling president. He is going to be a working president." And at his inexperience, "The forces of evil in this world will have no mercy for innocence." If the next president is inexperienced in making government work, he becomes a weak link in the whole chain of the free world. Then, after a last visit to the White House with Rayburn to try and persuade Eisenhower to publicly criticize Kennedy, the president was to recount that the two Texans felt he was a mediocrity in the Senate, a nobody who had a rich father, and they'd tell some of the goddamnedest stories. On Friday, July 8th, he flew to Los Angeles. Excoriating his top campaign workers, "He got mad," Herring says. "He felt we hadn't done our job. He didn't feel we had done enough with the delegates. If you'd done the job you were supposed to have done, I wouldn't be in this situation." He told them he was going to win despite their incompetence. Listing the states that were going to switch to him after the first ballot, he said it was going to be nip and tuck, but he still felt he would win. But an article on the front page of Saturday's New York Times showed how unrealistic it was for him to hope for the support of any substantial number of northern liberals. Top-level labor leaders passed the word to union delegates to the Democratic National Convention today to give no aid to Senator Lyndon B. Johnson for nomination to any office, it said. At a meeting of union leaders, one after the other had denounced what they called the Johnson Operation to hold liberal and labor legislation hostage to his candidacy, it said. While the article contained no direct quotes from the meeting, that was evidently the condition on which a description of it had been given to reporter Joseph Loftus. Loftus got the wording across nonetheless. The most powerful leader, gruff old George Meany, president of the 15 million member strong AFL-CIO, had, the article said, left no doubt that Senator Johnson should be regarded by all union delegates as an arch foe of labor. And, liberal leaders said Sunday, of civil rights as well. All the candidates had been invited to a rally organized by the NAACP that evening to support a civil rights fight in the convention's platform committee, and Johnson had accepted. Now he said he wasn't coming, sending former Interior Secretary Chapman in his place. The audience, about 6,000 persons, mostly African-American, was tough on all the candidates except for Humphrey, who was cheered when he rose to speak. When Kennedy was introduced, some boos mingled with the applause. He spoke in generalities, making no specific pledges on Negro rights, but apparently convinced the audience of his sincerity. At the end of his talk, the applause was no more than polite, but there were no boos. Then Chapman spoke. As soon as he mentioned Johnson's name, the jeering and angry shouts were so loud and went on so long that for a time it seemed he would not be allowed to continue. When, finally, he was, he said, "If I did not think Senator Johnson would support the Supreme Court decision on school desegregation wholeheartedly, I would not support him." The skeptical reaction drowned him out again. One by one all that weekend, delegations came down for Kennedy. Calling on Johnson in his suite, 7333, in the Biltmore Hotel on Saturday morning, DeSapio and Prendergast delivered in private the news that Mayor Wagner, who hadn't come, would announce publicly that afternoon. That Kennedy would receive 104 or 105 of New York's 114 votes. On Saturday also, Governors Docking and Lovelace announced that they would release the Kansas and Iowa delegations from their favorite son candidacies. Although Kennedy had only a bare majority of Kansas's 21 votes, under the unit rule, if the delegation was released, Kennedy would get all 21. The big headlines in the Sunday newspapers said, "Move to Kennedy nears stampede. Johnson seems headed for political Alamo." And later on Sunday, Dick Daley let it be known that Kennedy would get all but a handful of Illinois's 69 votes. There remained just one hope, what Joseph Alsop called the single major herd of delegates that is genuinely uncommitted. This is the Pennsylvania delegation, 81 strong, sternly commanded by the Sphinx of Harrisburg, Governor David Lawrence. Slim though the chance might be, it was definitely a chance. Despite the headlines, if Kennedy didn't take almost all of Pennsylvania's votes, he might still be well short of the 761 he needed. Pennsylvania would not caucus until Monday morning, and as Alsop wrote on Friday, the result of that caucus would be decisive for Kennedy's chances. "Everything depends on Pennsylvania," Lyndon Johnson said that weekend. "If we could have held Pennsylvania," John Connolly was to recall years later, "we would have stopped him." And that weekend, Lawrence was doing, as he had been doing for more than a year, everything he could to keep his state out of Kennedy's column. The son of an Irish teamster, David "Don't Call Me Boss" Lawrence, had dropped out of high school at 14 to run errands for a Pittsburgh alderman, and thereafter his education had been as a politician. And a formative moment had come in 1928. Idolizing another poor and uneducated Irishman up from the slums, Alfred E. Smith, for the social reforms Smith had enacted as governor of New York, Lawrence had thrown himself and his Pittsburgh machine into Smith's presidential campaign. The storm of anti-Catholic prejudice that sent the happy warrior to overwhelming defeat, fiery crosses had blazed on Midwestern hills as Smith's campaign train passed, had burned into Lawrence the belief that Roman Catholicism was an insurmountable handicap in American politics. In 1932, despite his admiration for Smith, he took his machine into Franklin D. Roosevelt's camp, solely, Lawrence's biographer wrote, on the religious issue. And then, in 1958, after four terms as Pittsburgh's mayor, he ran for the governorship. Until the end of his life, he never stopped talking about what had happened to him in that race, about the hate-filled letters that poured into his home, some of them worded so violently that he feared for his family's safety, about the ministers in Pennsylvania's rural Dutch districts who warned their congregants not to vote for a Roman Catholic, about how, although he had come out of Pittsburgh and Philadelphia and the hard coal counties with a huge plurality, He had almost lost anyway when the vote from the non-Catholic areas came in. On the morning after a Jefferson-Jackson Day dinner in 1959, Lawrence had attended a Sunday Mass together with Richard Daley, Robert Wagner, Carmine DeSapio, Mike DeSalle, and Pat Brown, a communion of the bosses. And during breakfast after church, Lawrence delivered his sermon, that Kennedy just can't win. Districts that have always gone Democratic, I lost because I was a Catholic. Now, on the eve of the 1960 convention, the stocky, grizzled ruler of the Pennsylvania Democrats was convinced that, despite West Virginia, nothing had changed. Kennedy's victory there might have eased the fears of some of those other leaders about anti-Catholic prejudice. It had done little to ease Lawrence's. "I figured he'll lose Pennsylvania, sure," he was to recall. And he was afraid that Kennedy's name at the top of the ticket would, by arousing anti-Catholic sentiment in those Dutch Democratic districts, drag other Pennsylvania Democrats down with him. Says an old friend who talked to Lawrence shortly after West Virginia, "What he wanted was to win. He was convinced that the whole ticket was going to go down the drain because you couldn't elect a Roman Catholic. An ambitious program he wanted to pass as governor depended on his narrow margin in the legislature. If Kennedy was the nominee, Lawrence recalls, I could see losing the legislature." And there were, besides, his feelings about Adlai Stevenson, feelings which, one reporter called, an almost youthful adoration. The admiration, almost awe, of the tough old boss, with little formal education, for Stevenson's learning, wit, and brilliance. He had played a crucial role in getting Adlai the nomination in 1952 and 1956. And, Lawrence's son was to say, in 1960, though I don't think his political sense was with Stevenson, his heart was with Stevenson. Lawrence himself would say, I was very enamored of Stevenson because I think of him as one of the ablest men in the world and the ablest man I ever met. The Kennedys had been working on Dave Lawrence not for months, but for years. Joseph Kennedy had made a substantial contribution to his 1958 gubernatorial campaign. Why would you want to contribute in Pennsylvania? Lawrence's protege, Joe Barr, had asked the patriarch at the time. In Pennsylvania's own non-binding 1960 primary, more than 175,000 Democrats, an astonishingly high number, had written in Kennedy's name, and more than half the state's 81 delegates were for him. But Lawrence wouldn't budge. We were all furious at him, Rose Kennedy would recall. Joe has worked with Lawrence all winter, but he still can't believe a Catholic can be elected. He has been one of the most exasperating and tantalizing forces. That didn't mean that Lawrence was for Johnson. If he felt a Catholic couldn't win, he had the same feeling about a Southerner, even after Johnson's speech at the Zembo Mosque. On a visit to the Taj Mahal near the end of May, he was given the full treatment. Emerging in a daze, he sought refuge in the office of Pennsylvania Senator Joseph Clark and told him in wondering tones that the man has sold himself on the idea that he is going to be our nominee and the next president. Now how can I ask Pennsylvania Democrats to vote for Lyndon Johnson? Over that weekend in Los Angeles, Johnson was working furiously to hold the Pennsylvania delegates. His partner in the effort was a key player in the Pennsylvania game, John L. Lewis, president of the United Mine Workers, who had been his ally, a secret ally, since labor union support was not a political desideratum in Texas, for years. The UMW's chief counsel, Welly Hopkins, a one-time Hill Country legislator for whom Johnson as a young man had campaigned in Texas, had carried cash back to that state for both of Johnson's Senate campaigns. In any state with as much coal as Pennsylvania, of course, the mine workers would be a potent political force. Lewis had already dispatched UMW Secretary Treasurer Tom Kennedy to Los Angeles, and on Lewis's instructions, Hopkins had been discussing with Johnson ways in which Johnson might hold at least a substantial block of the Pennsylvania delegation. The last chance melted away due to Stevenson's indecisiveness. Arriving in Los Angeles, Lawrence found that more of his Pennsylvania delegates than ever were for Kennedy, and Chicago's Daily let him see with his own eyes that Stevenson had little support even from his own state, inviting Lawrence to attend the Illinois caucus on Sunday, in which Stevenson received only a handful of votes. Nevertheless, meeting Sunday night with the man he had championed for almost a decade, Lawrence pleaded with him to announce that he was a candidate. "You'll have 85% of the Pennsylvania delegation," he said. "I can hold it. They're going to kill me, but I can hold it. They're all on the state payroll." And if he held Pennsylvania, Lawrence said, Kennedy couldn't win on the first ballot. "And this guy is dead if it goes to a second ballot. He's dead." But Pennsylvania was going to caucus the next morning. "You've got to tell me right now." Adlai was Adlai. "If the party wants me..." "No, no, Governor," Lawrence said. "Right now. I have to know right now." Finally, Stevenson said cavalierly, "Do what you have to do, Dave." Adlai's aide, Willard Wirtz, said in despair, "Governor, are you sure that's the message you want to give Governor Lawrence?" But Stevenson said it was. Adlai could have said anything but that, and he, Lawrence, would have stopped Pennsylvania from going to Kennedy, said another Stevenson aide. Lawrence had given Stevenson a last chance, and Stevenson had refused it. Lawrence told Stevenson that Pennsylvania would go for Kennedy at the caucus. All during that weekend, Welly Hopkins says, the UMW's Tom Kennedy had been working the Pennsylvania delegates, and there was some reason to believe that there might be a last-minute gambit, through Lawrence, that they be put in Lyndon's column. But he wasn't able to put it over, although he tried. Late Sunday night, Johnson learned what Pennsylvania was going to do when it caucused Monday morning. Nonetheless, that morning, before the actual vote, he had to attend a breakfast meeting of the Pennsylvania delegation, where he, Kennedy Symington, and, speaking for Stevenson, Mike Monroney, would give brief talks to the delegates before they voted. He had to sit beside Kennedy all through that breakfast, keeping a smile on his face. At one point, Lawrence opened the doors and let photographers in. Leaping to his feet, Johnson stood between Kennedy and Symington, who had remained seated, and put a hand on each of their shoulders so that in the photographs he would be the dominant figure. But after the photographers were ushered out, the doors were closed again, and Lawrence introduced the speakers. Johnson received polite applause. Then Lawrence introduced Kennedy. With a spontaneous roar, the delegates stood and cheered him. After the talks, the speakers left and the doors were closed again. Back in his suite at the Biltmore an hour later, Johnson got the exact count. He had received 4 of Pennsylvania's 81 votes, Stevenson 7.5, Kennedy 64. 1.5 had gone for others. Later that day, he had to keep a commitment to speak to New York. "I am not a naive person," Lyndon Johnson said. "I know that a preponderance of the cards are stacked against me here." Of the 114 delegates in the audience facing him, 4.5 would vote for him. That night, he sat watching the opening of the convention in his suite at the Biltmore, alone except for Jim Rowe. Rowe was staring at the screen when he heard a voice beside him say softly, "I don't see how we can stop this fellow." Tuesday brought 2 episodes of note. One was the wild demonstration, touched off by Senator Eugene McCarthy's emotional speech placing Stevenson's name in nomination. A riotous parade around the convention floor that moved television commentators to speculate that the convention might be stampeded for Adlai. The political pros in the hall, however, noticed that very few of the paraders were delegates. In terms of changing votes, the demonstration had little significance. In those terms, the other episode didn't have much significance either, but it may have given Lyndon Johnson a new appreciation of John F. Kennedy. Trying to give as many delegates as possible a chance to meet Kennedy, his campaign headquarters had sent a telegram signed by him to the chairman of each delegation, asking for permission to address it, to explain my views, and to answer their questions. The chairman of the Texas delegation was Lyndon Johnson, and no one had thought to omit him from the list. It was only a form telegram, but when Johnson received it, he seized upon it as the opening he had been waiting for, the opening that could, even at this late moment, change everything, a chance to trap Kennedy into a debate. "I want to get on the same podium with Jack," he told Irv Hoff. "I'll destroy him." Connolly, Reedy, and Busby, when they were called in, were unanimously enthusiastic. One major error by Kennedy, Connally felt, and the Kennedy bandwagon, which he believed was not yet on completely firm ground anyway, would be overturned. A reply from Johnson was drafted, ostensibly in response to your request, but in terms that would elevate the event to a more significant level. A debate between the two leading contenders for the nomination. It challenged Kennedy to appear together with him at 3 o'clock that afternoon before a joint caucus of the Texas and Massachusetts delegations, and debate the major issues, and on Tuesday morning, even before it was sent to Kennedy, Johnson called a press conference and read it to reporters. It would be in the interest of our party that this session be open to television coverage, it said. If it went well, enough delegates would be watching to tip the balance, Reedy said. Kennedy had every reason not to accept, and his advisers told him not to. As the front-runner, he had a lot to lose and not much to gain. But Kennedy did not look at it that way. His father heard about Johnson's telegram that morning as he was sitting next to the swimming pool at the Marion Davies estate, which he had rented for the duration of the convention, giving an interview to the friendly journalist John Siegenthaler. His son would be a damned fool to accept, the ambassador said. But Jack's sister Jean Kennedy Smith said, I know, Daddy, but he's challenged him to a debate. To Siegenthaler, she said, you'll see, that's the way they are. He'll debate him. He announced he would. In describing Johnson's reaction, Philip Graham was to call it tremendous exhilaration. Once again, he was a candidate for the presidency with a chance, even an unlikely one. He told Graham what he wanted to say, which seemed a bit harsh and personal. He began talking in ad hominem terms about Kennedy, and Graham tried to dissuade him, saying, no, we're not going to say that sort of thing. We're going to talk about the world situation. And he wrote a 10-minute high road statement for Johnson to use. In accepting Johnson's invitation, Kennedy had said that he had appeared before many delegations, and I've never found it necessary to bring the Massachusetts delegation with me. I will appear alone before the Texas caucus. Trying to elevate the newsworthiness of the event, Johnson had announced that Kennedy was violating the terms of his invitation, and Kennedy finally said he would try to round up some Massachusetts delegates, but there weren't more than a handful or two in the Crystal Ballroom of the Biltmore Hotel when Kennedy arrived, with his brother Robert and a few aides, a little after 3 o'clock. The entire 61-man Texas delegation seemed to be there, as well as scores of other Texans, the men in big Stetsons, the women wearing all the way with LBJ pins. Under glittering chandeliers, the huge ballroom was jammed wall-to-wall with reporters. TV cameras bristled like machine guns from every point in the ornate gallery, one wrote. As he took his seat on the stage, Kennedy wasn't at ease. A reporter noticed his legs shaking under his trousers. But no one seeing only his face would have known it. And when he rose to speak, looking out at the ballroom that one Texas reporter wrote, Johnson had packed full of his folks, Kennedy said with a smile that he was glad the vote for the nomination wasn't being taken there. I doubt whether there is any great groundswell for Kennedy in the Texas delegation, he said. The audience chuckled at that and laughed when, after promising to campaign for Johnson if Johnson won the nomination, he said, and if I am nominated, I am confident that Senator Johnson will take me by the hand and lead me through the length and breadth of Texas. He said he wasn't going to argue with Johnson on the issues, because I don't think Senator Johnson and I disagree on the great issues that are facing us, and said he admired him for his work as majority leader. If I am successful in this convention, he said, it will be the result of watching Senator Johnson for the last 8 years. I have learned the lesson well, Lyndon, and I hope it may benefit me in the next 24 hours. So I come here today full of admiration for Senator Johnson, full of affection for him, and strongly in support of him, for majority leader. The audience laughed again. When Kennedy sat down at the end of his opening statement, there was quite a bit of rather warm applause. Johnson started off on Phil Graham's high road, although it was an arm-waving, blustering journey. And when I take the oath of office next January... But before long, he veered off. He had gotten a civil rights bill through the Senate, he said, but not every senator had been present to help him. 6 days and nights we had 24-hour sessions, he said, shouting every word. Lyndon Johnson answered every one of the 50 quorum calls. Some men who would be president answered none. He had voted in all 45 roll calls, he said. Some senators missed 34. A Texas legislator, George Noakes, leaned over and whispered loudly to the other people in his aisle. Lyndon sure bear-trapped him, didn't he? After a brief whispered conference with his brother, Kennedy rose to reply. Johnson's face had been grim as he spoke. On Kennedy's face was a grin. Senator Johnson had criticized some senators, he said, but he had not identified those he was talking about, so I assume he was talking about some other candidate, not me. The grin broadened. I want to commend him for a wonderful record answering those quorum calls, he said. People in the audience started to chuckle, and then others started to laugh, and a wave of laughter swept over the hall. Turning to Johnson, Kennedy shook his hand for the photographers and walked out of the hall, his little band following him. Watching Johnson as Kennedy spoke, Arthur Schlesinger saw his face change. Johnson felt that Kennedy had the drop on him, he was to say. That was what the Texas delegates thought, too, even those who, like Jim Wright, had been Johnson's eager disciples. Wright, a very tough politician, he would later rise to Sam Rayburn's place as Speaker of the House, heard Johnson's attack, and then, he was to recall decades later, saw Kennedy give that big Irish grin of his and say, "Since Lyndon mentioned no names, I'm sure he wasn't talking about me." Then he began bragging about Lyndon. By the time he ended, he had won our admiration, begrudging but admiration. In fact, in describing the debate, Wright bestowed on Kennedy what was, for a Texan, the highest accolade possible. Jack Kennedy, he was to recall, had reminded him that afternoon of the legendary Texas Ranger who was sent in 1906 to a city down on the Rio Grande border in which a riot was raging. The city's sheriff had telegraphed Ranger headquarters for assistance and had been told it would arrive on the next train. When the train pulled in, and only one man disembarked, the dismayed sheriff asked, "Only one Ranger?" "Only one riot," the Ranger explained. When Jack Kennedy had walked into that hostile ballroom, packed with his enemies, Wright said, "Came in all alone, walked in bareheaded. I made that comparison in my mind. By the time he finished, we were all identifying with that old Texas Ranger." Even Johnson's most loyal staff members felt the same way. "Really, it didn't come off as we had expected it to," Jake Jacobson says. Months earlier, Jim Wright had tried to warn Lyndon Johnson about the Kennedy magic. Now Johnson had experienced it for himself. "He got cured once and for all of getting into a debate with Jack Kennedy," Irv Hoff says. After the debate, less than 24 hours remained before, on Wednesday, July 13th in mid-afternoon, the convention would be called to order to nominate the candidates. And those hours were filled with a desperate last round of infighting. Delaware and North Dakota were both states with 11 votes, which would, in both cases, be cast as a unit, and in both states a delegate with half a vote held the balance. Kennedy held North Dakota, but Johnson brought Delaware into his camp. And Robert Kennedy and John Connally were both pleading with Robert Minor. Kennedy for New Jersey to throw its 41 votes to his brother on the first ballot, Connally for the state to stick with Minor as a favorite son on the first ballot at least, and Connally won. Johnson raced from delegation to delegation in a last-minute attempt to pick up some votes. Bumping into Jack Kennedy once, he accused him of using unfair tactics. "Johnson's eyes were like flamethrowers," said a man who was present. His bile against Kennedy was spilling over. Before the Washington State delegation, he attacked the Kennedys, father and son, saying again that the father had been a Chamberlain umbrella man, while he himself had never thought Hitler was right, and bringing up Joe McCarthy. The Kennedys, he said, had advised the Wisconsin senator on strategy and contributed money to his campaigns, and of course Jack had not voted with the rest of the Democrats to condemn his methods. "I was not contributing comfort to his thinking or contributions to his campaign," Johnson said. "When he was on the march in this country and someone had to stand up and be counted, every Democratic senator stood up and voted with their leader," he said. That is, all those who were present, and more personal feelings spilled out as well. No one handed any wealth down to me, he told the Kentucky delegation. I haven't had anything given to me. Whatever I have and whatever I hope to get, I got through my own energy and talents. He had helped Kennedy in the Senate, he said, and now this young man I appointed to the Foreign Relations Committee claims he knows more about foreign affairs than I do. You know, there are some people who will throw crutches at their doctor and get smarter than their daddy. Johnson's emotions were no hotter than those of the Kennedy who hated him. Bobby Baker, to whom politics was all a game, if a dirty one, was slow to realize this. As one accustomed to the rough and tumble of politics, after which foes might sit down together over a drink, he had thought nothing of Johnson's attacks, and noticing Bobby Kennedy outside the Biltmore coffee shop where he and his wife Dorothy were eating, he invited him to join them. Then, however, in the course of what he regarded as normal banter between political adversaries, he ventured to remark that some of the Kennedy criticisms of Johnson had been a little rough. In that instant, Robert Kennedy's face had flushed so deep a red that Baker thought he might have a stroke. "You've got your nerve," he said. "Lyndon Johnson has compared my father to the Nazis, and John Connolly lied in saying my brother is dying. You Johnson people are running a stinking damned campaign, and you're going to get yours when the time comes." Baker tried to calm him, but there was no calming Robert Kennedy when his family was concerned. Leaning forward, clenching his fists, thrusting his face into mine, he went on shouting until he finally jumped up, threw some money on the table, and stalked off, on his face that glare that men feared. After the convention was gaveled to order at 3 o'clock that afternoon, Sam Rayburn got out of his seat in the Texas delegation's section to make the first nominating speech, and the 2,000 delegates on the floor of the Los Angeles Memorial Sports Arena rose in a great ovation as they saw the familiar bald head moving through a crowd to the high platform. Johnson had sent Lady Bird and his two daughters to his box in the arena. Mary Margaret Wiley and Johnson assistant Bob Waldron were in his suite with him, and George Reedy was in and out. Johnson sat on the edge of a sofa, hunched forward, watching the speaker on the television screen. Rayburn's speech was a very personal one. "I am going to present to you today a man that I have known since his babyhood," he said. "I knew his pioneer father and mother, who faced the ravages of the Great West when there was little or no civilization there. Lyndon Johnson," he said, "was a poor boy who dreamed great dreams, a young man who worked his way through school, a young man in his youth who did menial work, who climbed with an ambition, superb and superior. During his 47 years in Congress," Rayburn said, "he had served with 3,000 men and women. He knew leadership when he saw it, and Lyndon Johnson was a leader." In the left-hand pocket of Lyndon Johnson's suit jacket as he sat in his suite watching Rayburn was a folded sheet with the delegate count, and it showed that Kennedy was going to have enough votes to win on the first ballot. Just barely enough, but enough. Despite those hard figures, Johnson was evidently unable to give up his hopes. Perhaps feeling that Rayburn's speech might sway a few delegates' votes, and at the very last minute start a drift away from Kennedy, he tried a last maneuver. As the nominating speeches for other candidates dragged on into the early evening, he phoned at John Connolly, reaching him on the telephone that had been set up next to the Texas delegation's standard on the convention floor, and told him to suggest to the convention's chairman, Governor Leroy Collins of Florida, that since it was growing late, the convention should recess after the speeches and postpone the voting to the next day. Connolly made the request, but Collins quickly rejected it. At about 9:15, the voting began. By the state of Washington, Kennedy's count was 710. At West Virginia, it was 725. After Wisconsin, 748. Johnson had 405. The next state was Wyoming, Wyoming that Johnson could once have had so easily, but that he hadn't bothered to visit until it was too late. Tenno Roncalio still had only 10 of its 15 votes for Kennedy. The other 5 were under the control of the delegation's chairman, Tracy McCracken, a very, very conservative publisher who was a strong Johnson person. Ted Kennedy was standing with the Wyoming delegation. That morning, Bobby, counting delegates, had told him that the first ballot might come down to those 5 votes. Ted hadn't believed him, but he had gone to McCracken and asked him, "If it comes down to Wyoming, will you cast all 15 votes for my brother?" McCracken said, "I can't believe that after all those states it will come down to those 5 votes." But he said that if it did, he would cast the whole 15 votes for Kennedy. And now it did. "Wyoming casts all 15 votes for the next president of the United States," McCracken announced. Kennedy had 763. Sam Rayburn shut his eyes and began to cry. He put his head down on a friend's chest, and tears ran down his cheeks. After a while, he sat up in his seat, squared his shoulders, lit a cigarette, and took a long puff. After several states, seeing that Kennedy had won, switched to him to be with the winner, Kennedy finished the first ballot with 806 votes. Johnson had 409. All the other possibilities, Symington, Stevenson, Humphrey, and the various favorite sons, had a total of 306. For a western state to have cast the decisive votes was a fitting denouement to the fight for the nomination, for it was western votes that had given Kennedy victory and denied the possibility of victory to Lyndon Johnson. His boasting during the Kennedy debate that he had passed a civil rights bill had cost him some Southern support. At the last minute, Mississippi had switched its 23 to Governor Ross Barnett and Florida its 29 to Senator Smathers as a protest. But he had still received 281 votes from the South. He had added to those the 54.5 he had expected from border states Oklahoma and Kentucky, and 40 scattered tallies from other states. But out of the 172 possible votes from the western states, he had received only 22.5. Kennedy had received 119, other candidates a total of 30.5. Had he received more, had he held the West, would Kennedy have won on the first ballot, or would the convention have ended with a different outcome? McCracken's announcement came at 10 minutes before 11. Johnson had changed into pajamas and bedroom slippers as he saw how the vote was going, and was sitting on a couch sipping a scotch and soda. And that's how Lyndon Johnson was watching when he lost his chance at the prize he had yearned for all his life. Summoning Reedy and Busby, he told them, "I want to send a telegram to the nominee and pledge my full support. They should draft one, bring it back for his approval, and then, to make absolutely sure Kennedy received it, make 2 copies, one to be sent by Western Union to the nominee himself, and one for Connolly to deliver personally to the Kennedy people. They should do it as quickly as possible," he said. "I'm going to sleep. I don't want to talk to anybody." Chapter 4. The Back Stairs. And then, the next morning, Thursday, July 14th, at about 8 o'clock, the telephone rang in the darkened bedroom of Lyndon Johnson's suite. Its jangling woke Lady Bird, and when she picked it up, it was Senator Kennedy, asking to speak to Lyndon, who was still asleep in the other bed. Saying, "Just a minute," she shook him awake, and when he picked up the phone, Kennedy said he would like to come down to talk to him, and it was agreed he would do so at about 10 o'clock. Jumping out of bed, Johnson went into the suite's living room and told a secretary to have it neatened up, and then, going back into the bedroom and sitting on the bed, he began making telephone calls. One was to John Connolly, who was shaving. "Jack Kennedy just called me," Johnson said. "He wants to come down and see me. What do you think he wants?" "I think he wants to offer you the vice presidency," Connolly said. And Johnson knew Connolly was right. He called Jim Rowe. "We had lost and it was over," Rowe was to recall. "I was still asleep." "Kennedy is coming down here in a few minutes," Lyndon Johnson told him. "And I think he's going to offer me the vice presidency. What should I do?" "Still half asleep," Rowe mumbled. "What do you want that for? You've got the power now." The next words in his ear woke him up. "Power is where power goes," Lyndon Johnson said. "I'll still control the Senate." And the way he said it, all of a sudden a bell rang in my head, as sleepy as I was. This guy is really thinking about it. In all the reams of speculation that had been printed during the previous weeks and months about the eventual makeup of the Democratic ticket, there had been very little about the possibility that Lyndon Johnson would be in its second slot. Almost no one in the political world even suspected that the majority leader of the Senate would seriously consider trading that position for the vice presidency. During Johnson's 6 years in the job, the leadership had been a position of immense power, the second most powerful man in Washington, and the vice presidency was a position of almost no power at all. Virtually, its only constitutional responsibility that of presiding over the Senate, but shall have no vote, except in case of a tie, of so little power, in fact, that its first occupant, John Adams, called it the most insignificant office that ever the invention of man contrived or his imagination conceived. Its powerlessness was a staple of Washington humor. Everyone in the Capitol, it seemed, knew the joke about the unfortunate mother who had two sons who were never heard from again. One was lost at sea, and the other became vice president. Everyone quoted, actually misquoted, the remark that one vice president, the Texan John Nance Garner, had made about the job. It's not worth a bucket of warm spit. Actually, as Johnson knew because Rayburn had told him, Cactus Jack had said that what the job was not worth was a bucket of warm piss. Any holder of the job became automatically a figure of ridicule in power-obsessed Washington, and indeed in the world beyond. The obscurity of the office had been the comic theme of a popular American musical of the 1930s, the Gershwin's Of the I Sing, which won a Pulitzer Prize for its depiction of a presidential campaign. In an early scene, none of a political party's leaders can recall the name of the party's vice presidential candidate, and neither can the presidential candidate, John P. Wintergreen. The name is Alexander Throttlebottom, and when he arrives on stage, it is to tell the leaders that he wants to resign from the ticket. The shame that would be brought on his mother should he win and actually be the vice president might be too much for her to bear, he says. Although he is talked out of quitting and his ticket wins, he is still unrecognized. After the election, the only way he can get into the White House is by joining a guided tour. And Johnson himself had repeatedly said, whenever the subject was raised by some reporter in 1958 and 1959, and indeed in the early months of 1960, that he would never consider leaving the Senate and the leadership for the vice presidency, in which his role in the Senate would be only to preside over it. "I wouldn't trade a vote for a gavel," was his invariable remark. The remark was delivered, what's more, with seeming conviction. When Hugh Seide had persisted in probing Johnson about the possibility during a visit to the ranch in the spring of 1960, Johnson got irritated and stormed. He declared that the vice presidency was a worthless job compared with being Senate leader, related the sad tenure of Cactus Jack Garner, and said Speaker Sam Rayburn had told him to stay far away from it. "If he could not be president, he would stay in the Senate," Johnson had told me with such rage and finality, his nose an inch from mine, that I chalked him off. But in fact, Johnson had for some time been seriously thinking about making the trade, as Jim Rowe himself realized as soon as he became fully awake after talking to Johnson that morning. Rowe should have been more aware of that possibility than almost anyone, he would recall years later with a wry smile, since he himself had been not only an eyewitness to, but the key go-between in, a previous Johnson effort to make that precise trade. Following the failure of Johnson's bid for the Democratic presidential nomination at the party's 1956 National Convention, the majority leader had made a try for the vice presidential nomination, sending a message, "Tell him I want it," to presidential nominee Adlai Stevenson, and it had been Rowe whom Johnson had selected to carry the message. Stevenson, who was about to startle the convention by announcing that he would not suggest a vice presidential nominee but would let the delegates freely choose one, responded to the message noncommittally, and when Rayburn heard about Johnson's attempt, he reacted with such furious disapproval, "I saw that red flush coming up over his neck and head, and I just said to myself, 'Uh-oh,'" Tommy Corcoran recalls, that Johnson hastily sent the embarrassed Rowe back to withdraw the demand. Several considerations made him think about it seriously. Some of them were merely tactical. No matter who won the presidency that November, Kennedy or the as-yet-unnamed GOP nominee. If Lyndon Johnson continued as majority leader, he would still, within the world of the Senate, maintain much of the unprecedented power he had created for himself. Emboldened by the liberal success in 1958, Senate liberals had challenged him not only on the filibuster, but by demanding that the Democratic Conference, or caucus, take up a number of measures to end what Wisconsin's William Proxmire called his one-man rule, including a resolution that the caucus, not the leader, name the members of the policy committee. Liberal senators had delivered fiery speeches, and the Washington Press Corps had taken this threat to Johnson's rule seriously, but the definitive verdict